Welcome to the Backstory Podcast. I'm your host, Colby Kolb. And on this episode, I'm just super hyped for this one right here because I'm an original hip hop kid. And there was an artist that came out that really, one of the first artists to really change the game, but also an artist to inspire so many generations of MCs, Mr. Big Daddy Kane. Wow. And actually, Kane, you know, I talk about this, we're celebrating 50 years of hip hop, and you're from Brooklyn. And, you know, hip hop kind of started in the Bronx, and then we had all of this Queens energy happen. But you were really one of the first major forces to come out of Brooklyn. Talk about just being a kid growing up in Brooklyn and New York City and all of the energy of hip hop happening around you and how it inspired you.
I got my first dose of hip hop, I would say, in the year of 1977, going to a block party, hearing a DJ by the name of Master D playing. And he was rocking the block party, but he threw on Love Is the Message. And the way he was, you know, cutting it up, backspinning, yep. I'm just sitting there like mesmerized. And then I saw, I want to say, about 20 people, like in what looked like a welfare line, you know? And they were all waiting to get on the mic, and everybody got on the mic, and they started spitting rhymes. And this went on for probably about a good 15 minutes off of just Love Is the Message,
yeah,
you know? And when he went to playing another record, they all just dispersed. And, you know, it was like, I was like, yo, this energy is crazy. And from that point on, I was hooked. I wanted to go to every block party where this type of vibe was happening, where they're cutting up the disco breaks and rappers are rhyming. And I fell in love right there. I was 9 years old.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you're watching this energy happen around you. You're starting to catch that buzz. So did you start then just rhyming all the time, anytime you could do it as a preteen? Did you start battling folks? What was it? What was your goal, you know, your lane for becoming Big Daddy Kane?
Well, because it seemed like the element of DJing was the more popular thing.
Yep.
And yeah, I guess basically because the element of DJing was the more popular thing, I wanted to do that. That's what I gravitated to. So my uncle bought me some turntables, and I started DJing, I want to say, around 1980.
Okay.
And I was sticking to it. I was, you know, getting, you know, fairly decent. But then someone broke into my grandmother's house and stole my turntables.
Oh.
Yeah. So that kind of ended that. And then my cousin, the same cousin that took me to a block party in 77, he started rapping. And he was like an older cousin I looked up to. So I was like, I'm going to try it to get down with him. And he told me that I was too young. And he was rhyming with these other two guys from around the corner. So I started writing battle rhymes. I figured if I could beat the other two dudes, he'd put me down with his crew.
Right.
So I started writing battle rhymes, and I battled the other two guys in his crew. And, you know, I came back. I was like, yo, I beat O and I beat Spence. Can I be down now? And he said, I'm not rapping no more. I'm playing football. So that left me alone, you know, and I just kept with it and kept doing it on my own.
So let's talk about your name, Big Daddy Kane, because it's a mixture of a couple of different things and based around television and movies. So let's talk about Big Daddy Kane. Where did that come from?
Well, originally I was just using MC Kane.
Yep.
And the Kane part came from the David Carradine character in a TV show, Kung Fu. Because my fascination for, Kung Fu theater, you know, Saturday, 3 o'clock, you know, Sunday, 1 o'clock, I'm in front of the TV. I don't care what's happening. Like, we could have been in the middle of a game of red rover, red light, green light, you know, 3 o'clock, I'm out.
Yeah. Yeah.
So when they knew I was out, you know, other kids, you know, they like, oh, okay, we just lost Bruce Lee, you know, we just lost Young Grasshopper, we just lost Kane. You know, and out of the three names, I kind of like Kane better than Young Grasshopper and Bruce Lee. So I used MC Kane, you know.
So then you had a connection and a relationship with Biz Markie. And talk a little bit about that, because Biz was doing his thing. And then he ended up getting a record deal as you on the same label. But you and Biz together was the first part of this.
Yeah. 1984, I was still a local battle rapper going around different projects in Brooklyn battling MCs. And my cousin was dating this guy from Long Island, from Central Islip. And he'd always come around talking about Bismarcky this, Bismarcky that, always telling me about this dude. I was sick of hearing about him. So one day he told me, you know, that Biz is in the Albee Square Mall. And I was like, okay, can you take me to him? So he took me in the mall. And, you know, as we was getting closer, I was like, all right, I'm going to ask your man for a battle. And after, from this point on, I don't want to hear nothing about this dude no more, you know?
Yeah.
He introduced me. I asked Biz for a battle. We battled. And after the battle, he said, yo, man, you real dope, man. You should get down with me. Like, I be doing a lot of shows in the Bronx, Harlem, Long Island. And I guarantee you, if you get down with me, I'm going to get you a record deal one day. And I had, you know, I had never performed. All I did was just go to projects and just battle people, or block parties and battle people. I'd never performed before. So I'm like, okay, cool. And we started doing shows. We was doing a lot of shows for these guys called Mike and Dave. They used to give a lot of parties in the New York area, and they would pay opening acts as much as $50. But the $50 was always in singles. So,
but $50 was a lot in 84, 85, bro. That was good money.
Yeah, but, you know, riding home, you know, 3 o'clock in the morning with a knot of money, but it's all singles.
That's true. That is.
Yeah. All singles. So, yeah, I guess somewhere in the mix there, MC Kane wasn't only my rapper name, it was also my stripper name.
So, you did a song with Biz called Just Rhyming with Biz.
Yeah, what happened was, when he had the idea of Make the Music, he came to me and asked me to write it for him. And I didn't understand, because he was beatboxing and I was rapping.
Right.
So I'm like, Tom, don't you mean you want me to write a rhyme for me to say about you making the music? And then you make the music with your mouth?
Right.
And Biz said, okay, Kane. I ain't see him no more.
Wow.
he just vanished. I ain't see him no more.
Wow.
Like, you know, months later, the song came out. You know, I guess he wrote it on his own or whatever, but the song came out. But then he came back and he said, I got an idea. I want to use the Nobody Beats the Wiz jingle and say Nobody Beats the Biz. And I want to create this new style where I just be like, zooka, 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 zian. You know, that's the way he do it.
Yeah.
So this time I wasn't messing up. I said, okay, Biz, whatever you want.
Right. You know? And by the way, Nobody Beats the Wiz in New York City. The Wiz is sort of like Best Buy.
Yeah.
You know, it was like the spot. Yeah. And the commercials were all over the TV. Nobody Beats the Wiz. So that was a brilliant, like, repurpose of something local in New York, national. But go ahead.
Yeah, so after I did that, he started doing shows, and he took me out on the road with him to perform in the middle of his show. And sure enough, you know, he ended up getting me signed to Cold Chillin' Records as well. And that's where it all started.
And Cold Chillin' was really like, you had Def Jam and Cold Chillin' were two of the big artist-driven hip-hop labels. And Cold Chillin' was just an amazing roster, because, you know, you had the likes of Kool G Rap, Biz, you. I mean, it was just
Roxanne Shanté. MC Shan.
But talk a little bit about the symphony, because I feel like the symphony was just a moment where it's just, we knew who you were, who you was, but that particular record was just iconic for that time.
After I did Roar.
Right, your first song.
Yeah, when I did Roar, that same night, me and G-Rap, I had G-Rap with me, and me and G-Rap just rhymed over the beat again.
Mm-hmm.
And Marley would play it with me and G rhyming over the track to Roar. And people, you know, would call up the WBLS, which is radio station Marley Smith on, and request a song on the radio. Yo, can we hear the Kane and G-Rap version of Roar? They was calling. So Marley said, hey, I want y'all to do this same thing, but on my album. So it was a song that me and G-Rap was supposed to do together. Craig G got wind of it, and he said that he wanted to be on it. So Marley asked me, could Craig, and I just heard this new song from Craig called Duck Alert, where he was dissing DJ Red Alert. And I'm like, damn, Craig came a long way from Transformers.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
I'm like,
yeah,
he's spitting hard. Yeah. I'm like, yeah, Craig can be on it.
Yeah, and in all transparency, at that time, there was a radio sort of beef between Red Alert and Mr. Magic.
Yeah.
They were on two different radio stations, but really the only sources for hip-hop in America really at that moment.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So that's then at that point, it became me, G-Rap, and Craig. And then the day we was taking the photos for Marley album shoot is the day that we actually recorded the symphony. And we got to Marley crib that day, and Marley said that this is his new artist, Master Ace, and he wanted to put him on the song. And Ace, you know, like he had these big Woody Allen glasses on.
Yeah.
So I went to G-Rap, and I'm like, I'm not messing with glasses. I'm out. I'm about to say I'm going to get some pizza, and then I'm bouncing. And G-Rap's like, you know, I'm not messing with him either. I'm out too. You ain't leaving me. I'm out too. So we were getting ready to leave, and I don't know what held us up, or might have been a discussion about who gonna go first on the song, something like that.
Right.
And then Ace ended up going, and he spit. And I turned to G. I was like, yo, glass is kind of nice, you know? Yeah. And I wasn't, you know, I was comfortable then. And I'm glad he was a part of the song. Actually, I'm glad he was a part of the Juice crew, because, like, Ace was that bonding guy. He was the guy that really envisioned everyone working as a unit.
Yeah.
You know, that was his mindset.
He was a college student, too, at the time.
That's probably why them glasses were so damn
big. Yeah, yeah. He was. I think he went to the University of Rhode Island. Is where he was going. So he was trying. He was doing the rap thing while he was trying to finish education. But let's rewind, Kane, just a little bit, because Raw was your first song that we heard, and then it was a symphony.
Not actually.
What was the first song?
Just Rhyming with Biz.
Just Rhyming. Okay. Well, yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Just Rhyming with Biz. But Raw was like that moment record that was
the breakout.
Yeah, the breakout.
Yeah.
So, talk about just the first time you heard your song on the radio. Where were you, and what was that like for you growing up in New York? You knew about Mr. Magic. You had Red Alert. And then your song is on the radio.
Me and my boy Mad Money Murph, we was at another one of our schoolmates, Brownstone, brother by the name of Lou. We were all hanging out on the steps one night and heard World, Premier, Mia. That's how Mr. Magic, you know, play a new song. And he dropped the Just Rhyming with Biz, and we went bananas on the steps, then ran to the corner. I don't know, we bought about maybe like 640s or OE. Yeah, and it just became a celebration, you know?
Yeah.
It was crazy. I mean, it was like, yeah, I felt like y'all remember that scene from the Five Heartbeats? Duck, our song on the radio. Yeah. That mood, you know? But as it was playing, and since, you know, Red Alert didn't really consider me part of the beef between BDP and Juice Crew,
yep,
he was playing it as well.
Yeah, yeah.
So it
was, and Red Alert was really the premiere. He was the first one on the radio, so he was like...
Nah, Magic.
Magic was first?
Magic.
Rap Attack was? Okay.
Yeah, Magic was first.
Okay.
And then when they tried to force Magic to play R&B, he went back to HBI, and then that's when Kiss hired Red Alert.
Red Alert. Okay.
And BLS realized their mistake and brought Magic back.
Got
but Magic
it.
Was first.
Wow. I'm learning today. So you get your record on the radio.
Yeah. Just Rhyme with Biz is playing on the radio, but I'm sitting at home broke because everybody or the promoters think it's a Biz song. Because Biz started off first and Biz is already an established artist. Nobody knew who the hell I was. So I'm home broke. Me and, you know, Scoob Lover, we still got to steal cans of shrimp and Mrs. Paul's fish stick from the supermarket just to eat.
And that would be your dancer,
yeah,
correct?
Because, you know, not getting no money. Because everybody thought that it was Biz's song. So our Fly Ty, who ran Coachella Records, I'm begging him constantly, please, man, let me put out a new song. Please let me put out a new song. He's like, nah, there's still life in this. There's still life in this. So, I mean, this went on for months. And then finally he just gave in and was like, you know what, go ahead. And then that's when we recorded Raw. And that's the main reason why I started off saying, here I am, R.A. Dope, because I felt like finally my
Your
turn.
Moment. Yeah. Long Live the Kane, your debut album. And then the summer of 88, Ain't No Half-Steppin', which was just still an iconic song. Talk a little bit about putting that song together and how were you reacting to how fast it moved and the reactions that you were getting, not just out of New York, but all over the country from that song.
I don't know if I ever told this story in an interview, but the day that I got the beat for Ain't No Half-Steppin', two iconic songs came that day.
Okay.
I had went over to, because Biz used to live with Kool V, his DJ.
Yep.
And I went over to Kool V house just to hang out, and there was a little paper bag. And I asked Kool V, yo, these some new records. He was like, those Biz records, some stuff that he bought. So I'm like, let's go through them. So we going through them. And then I hear the song from the Emotions, the Blind Alley, you know, which was the beat for Ain't No Half Stepping. I'm like, oh, yeah, this is hot. So Cool V looped it up in the mixer, and I start writing. Biz is not there. Biz calls, screaming, I found it. I found it. I finally found it. I'm telling you, I'm going platinum with this. Because there's this song that he had been looking for like about a year and a half. And we like, you found what? I found it. It's Freddie Scott. You got what I need. I'm telling you, I'm going platinum.
Wow.
So I'm like, so since you all happy about that, then you probably don't mind if I take this here Blind Alley off your hand. You can have that. I don't give a, you know, sugar, honey, iced tea about that. So that day, he gave me the beat to Ain't No Half Steppin', and he found the beat to Just a Friend.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Tell me about the Where did that come from?
I think that was an accident. Because, like, Marley have the click track that start before the beat. Mm-hmm. So you're hearing the... And I was just going along with the click track. Just Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Man, that's just...
Yeah, just wait. I just had the headphones on, wait for the beat to drop, and just said it.
So the song just takes off, and then you release your debut album, Long Live the Kane, which is an instant classic. What were your thoughts about that particular album and just the process of putting it together, and what were one of your favorite moments from recording that album?
Well, with working on Long Live the Kane, it was like I had seen so much from, you know, what Biz was doing. Because Biz, he's coming to me like, you know, like, yo, that Vapor's word, we got to make a song about that. But we need to talk about people that tried to dump on us and how they ended up catching the Vapors. And, they, like, you know, I got, like, remember that story you told me about? Such, you should write about that. Yo, ask Vaughn about when he was working for Vogel's Record Store, and stuff like that. So it was like the creativity, you know, like that he had, I was like trying to, like, really, you know, use that. And what I was doing to create my album is just that, you know, Biz like a bunch of funny and silly stuff.
Yep.
I was trying to make it more serious, but, you know, use what I learned from Biz to really create an album.
So first album just blows. I mean, it was just then and now all of a sudden you're making money and you're touring. What was that like for you just going across the country and performing, a kid from Brooklyn, and you're very young and all of a sudden you're in all these cities and just doing shows and everybody knows your name?
You know, back then, you come out with a hip-hop jam, and you're doing shows in New York, Jersey, Philly,
yep.
Connecticut.
Yep.
And that's pretty much the extent of it. Oh, and L.A., because you had Greg Mack on
right.
K-Day
yep.
in L.A. But that was pretty much the extent of it, you know? You wasn't really, really around the world like that. So coming out, you know, it was crazy. And you go overseas, and my mentality was what the people in those areas listen to. So I do my show the way I know to do it. And then you talking to someone in England or someone in the Netherlands, like Amsterdam, and they're like, you know, why you didn't do Long Live the Kane? Huh? You know, it's like, you know, yeah. Oh, and young ladies like, you know, you should have performed the day of my... And I'm like, y'all want to hear that?
Yeah.
And then you're talking to people in there, saying, so you're from Brooklyn, you, and they know your whole history because they done read all the liner notes and found it. I'm like, wow. So, like, next time I went overseas, you know, I had more songs in the repertoire, you know?
Yeah. So there's always that weird period between your first and second album for any artist, especially when your first album is great. And then you became sort of highly anticipated second album. What's it going to be, Big Daddy Kane? Did you feel that pressure, or were you just like, man,
any pressure. I actually felt better going in the studio to record my second album.
Mm-hmm.
Because that first album, you know, I'm just a kid from the streets of Brooklyn. I can only talk about what I know, what I've seen in Brooklyn, or what I've seen in those particular cities that I've just mentioned where, you know, new artists perform. That's all I've seen. You know, now I've traveled internationally. I've seen so much more. I have an understanding of what underground hip hop fans like, what commercial hip hop fans like. I have an understanding of what men like, what women like. I have an understanding of what, you know, Americans like, what Europeans like, what Asians like. You know, so it's a much, much more international perspective that I have and more well-rounded with the whole thing. So I can talk about and address all of that on an album.
So the album comes out and another classic, and you have a little bit for everybody. Then it's the big song with Smooth Operator, which, again, talk about the creation of that one, because we wore that one out that summer.
Smooth Operator. Smooth Operator. Oh, man. It's like, you know, All Night Long was one of those anthems that, you know, drove everybody crazy. You know, I don't know how far y'all go back, but, you know, that come on. You can't, oh, you just want to do the Smurf and whatnot. Close your eyes and just, you know, it was just one of those jams. So I was like, I really want to use this.
Right.
I really want to use this. But I knew that, you know, it was a big song for the Mary Jane Girls. So I called Rick James because I had just wrote something for him.
And you were all sort of similar label situation, right?
Because right, he was on Warner Brothers as well. So I called Rick James and asked him, could he help?
By the way, he said he called Rick James. Like, how, in that era, that's like, wow, you called Rick James? That's crazy.
So I called him. I was like, yeah, I want to use All Night Long for my new album. You know, I got a dope idea, and I was, you know, just want to make sure that it can get cleared. And he's like, use any of them bitches' shit. You can use any of them bitches' shit. You need to use In My House. That was the biggest song for them bitches. Like, no, I'm going to stick with All Night Long, but thanks, Rick, man. You know, I'm like, you know.
Right, right.
He's like, come on, Daddy Kane. You know how we do. Use any of that. Man, Rick, thanks, man.
Rick,
appreciate
was a
you,
wild
man.
Dude, man.
Yeah. So, you know, he made it possible, you know, Rick made it possible that, you know, we can get the sample cleared and go through it. And, yeah, the rest was history.
Yeah. And then you had Mortal Kombat. And one of the songs that my personal favorite from that album was.
That's my favorite verse, too, by the way.
Okay.
Mortal Kombat.
Young, Gifted, and Black, to me, was like one. I mean, we had Public Enemy at that time. They were doing their thing. But that particular record really resonated. Because you were like, you were sort of, you know, you were doing your thing as a hardcore rapper in the rap world, but you were making a statement on that song, and it was just and it's just that song. I get lost in it. I still listen to it to this day. Like,
thank you.
That the way it's almost like you're beating up the beat as you're rapping it. I don't know how to explain it, but it's just that's the way it felt when you rapped that song.
I mean, you know, it meant a lot, and I felt like I covered so many issues that were going on at that time period.
Yes.
You know, and then also having, you know, Minister Farrakhan's voice at the top of the song.
Yeah.
You know, that was something, you know, new, and, you know, a lot of people were scared to do it at that point in time.
Yep.
You know, so yeah, it meant to, and it was one of those Philly bangers too.
For sure,
Set It Off was number one.
Yes,
but Young, Gifted, and Black might have been number two.
Yeah,
you know, yeah. It was definitely
Set It Off was like, man, bro. Yeah. First of all, you was just like, you were rapping so fast, but it was just a song like that. They're just so memorable, right? Like, you just don't forget those songs. And I feel like, you know, we're on a Joyner cruise. And what's great about the cruise is a whole bunch of DJs from all over the country. And when you go to particular parties and they play certain songs like that, it just drives you. It's like it takes you back to where you were at that time and that energy. And to be an artist that made those records and that folks were, like, moving to your stuff, that has to just be, like, even to this day, everywhere you go.
Set It Off is my drive.
Yeah.
Set It Off is my drive. That's the song that drives me. Yeah. I mean, you know, I'm 54 years old with arthritis in my back. So sometimes I'll be tired, you know, in a little pain. But, you know, by the time I get to, and this groove is what's next, I'm 19 again, man. For real. And nothing else matters.
Yeah.
You know, I'm like, you know, me and Dr. Gavankar can work this out tomorrow. Tonight, y'all got to have it. Y'all about to get it, you know?
Yeah.
You know, for real. I mean, I always do that song early in the show because it gives me so much energy. I'm ready for war.
Yeah.
When, you know, and the funny thing about it is the whole concept of starting off with the Let It Roll Get Bold before the beat drop was I was riding the car one day listening to Sex Machine.
Okay.
And I'm like, yo, I want to do something like this. Where I'm just, it's just mad energy before the beat even come on. Because, like, when I'm hearing James, like, I want to get into it. Moving, grooving, can I count it off? I'm like, I want to do something like this, but do it in a rap form. You know, that's
right.
What inspired me to start it that way.
Right.
You know, yeah.
So you have that particular song and that particular energy. and you kind of like Cold Chillin', you stepped away from Cold Chillin' at some point and signed a major deal with MCA. But at the time, it was a historic deal for a rapper to jettison from one of the labels that they got started to a major. Talk about that moment for you going to MCA.
All that money wasn't even worth it. I should have kept my ass at Warner Brothers.
Okay.
Straight up. You know, because, I mean, I felt like at least the people at Warner by then had an understanding of Big Daddy Kane.
Yep.
And had an appreciation for hip-hop because they were real nervous dealing with Shan and Shante, you know, because, you know, they was wildin'.
Right.
Then dealing with me, it was the type of thing where they felt like, okay, he's real professional. Oh, wow, we can get him in Jet Magazine. We can get him in Essence Magazine. You know, like stuff that they're used to doing with their R&B and pop artists, they were able to do with me.
Yep.
You know, so I felt like they had a better understanding of hip-hop. When I went to MCA, it was a machine, man.
So they dangled a big check, but there wasn't really much beyond that.
Yeah, I mean, it was the type of thing where, you know, I can talk to you, give you the whole rundown of whatever it is that you're asking me. Okay, here it is. This is, okay, yeah, that's what this is. And an hour later, someone from another department called me and asked me the same exact questions. I'm like, yo, you can't just, all right, you know. And, yeah, it was just a machine.
Yeah. So was it just a money play, or did Ty try to salvage it or keep you on or offer you
well,
something?
Well, me and Ty, at that particular time, me and Fly Ty was on bad terms.
Yeah.
We were on bad terms, and there was the very special song with Spinderella.
Yep.
Which I felt like, okay, I see the commercial potential. It needs to be a single, but afterwards, we need to drop some street stuff. It's like, you know, people looking at me, you know, as being too commercial.
Right.
We need to drop some street stuff and it need a video. And, you know, they refused to do it. And that was my last album. So I just said, deuces,
okay.
You know?
Yeah. So one of the things that did happen out of that MCA project was you did a posse record, going back to your early days with the symphony. You create your own sort of version of the symphony, and you introduce the world to Jay-Z, to the world, who was an up-and-coming rapper in Brooklyn, just like Biggie, who had already been out, but they had looked up to you. You were sort of this iconic figure to them to this day, and you put this song out, and you have ODB on it, who was Wu-Tang had just come out. Shaheem the Rugged Child, who was supposed to be the next artist coming out. But talk a little bit about Show and Proof. Talk a little bit about that song and talk about how you opened up the door for all of these future voices in hip-hop.
Well, at that particular time, we were recording demos for Jay-Z, trying to get him signed. And then it was just like, okay, it's not working. You just need to be out there.
Yeah.
So let's get you on something. And, you know, Sauce was his man, you know, who also, you know, I was also trying to, you know, work with. But, you know, Jay-Z was the main focus. So it was like, okay, let's get Jay and Sauce on here. And Shaheem, his label, like, he came and did the Superfest with me. He performed, like, his label was like, yo, we would like for you to take him out with you. We'll pay the such and such. So I took Shaheem on the Budweiser Superfest with me. So we became good friends. You know, nice little kid, man. And I was like, well, let's try to, you know, let's have him on it as well. And, you know, just try to, like, you know, as you said, like the symphony, another posse cut. And, you know, we put it together. And Jay-Z and Sauce, they cursed me out that day about about a personal issue I'm not even going to get into.
Okay.
And Old Dirty came staggering in the last minute with his crutches and dropped his verse. And, yeah, I mean, we was, you know, like, everybody was excited. And DJ Premier produced the track.
Yeah. So you obviously helped Jay-Z early on. What do you think about what he's become as an artist and just as an entrepreneur? Did you see a little of that back then?
Honestly, no. Back then, if you'd have said, yo, who you think going to blow from the camp, I would have said Sauce, because Sauce had the personality.
Yeah.
Jay was super quiet.
Yeah.
He just was a lyrical beast. You know, he was sarcastic, but, you know, he was mad quiet. So it's like to see what he has become and, you know, how he opened up. And to hear him speak a lot of times and the things that he say and the jewels that he be dropping, I'm like so proud of that dude, you know.
Yeah.
I'm so, like, you know, on like, you know, because, yeah, I mean, like, next to LL, I don't know who else has had that type of longevity in hip-hop, you know. So I'm, like, so happy and proud of his career as an artist and just as proud of him as a businessman, you know, becoming a billionaire. Is he the first billionaire in hip-hop?
Sort of. I guess Dre, maybe Dre was first.
Okay,
it don't matter. It's all, listen, we got to celebrate
$1 billion,
him.
So, yeah. you know.
And from Brooklyn, right? Like, that's amazing.
Yeah, you know, so, yeah, I'm real happy and proud of the brother, man. Yeah.
Well, you know, Kane, you are very humble about it, but you really were that first artist from Brooklyn that really just lit the light for Biggie and Jay-Z, because they've, you know, I remember interviewing Big early on and how much of an inspiration you were for him and the connection with the DJ, Mr. C, who was your DJ. And,
well, that's who connected us.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what I'm saying. So you had all of that energy. And then for Jay-Z, who mentioned you in a couple of his songs early on, but, you know, always looked at you as an inspiration. You know, we have to give you your flowers because you're one of these pioneers that just really opened up the door and really made this thing we call hip hop a real fun aspect of all of our lives. And, you know, man, kudos to you for that.
Thank you. Thank you. You know, I'm going to tell you, around the time of Party and Bullshit and Dreams, you know, Mr. C, he would always, yo, come on, man. You don't hear it? I'm like, nah, I don't hear it.
Wow.
And not, I don't mean like, yeah. I don't think Biggie is dope.
Right.
He was trying to say, you don't hear yourself in him. I'm like, nah, I don't hear it. Come on, man. You listen. I'm like, I don't hear it. See, I don't hear it. I think I like him. I think he's dope. I just don't hear it. And then the remix to One More Chance came out. And then I called C. Yeah, you're right. I see it. I'm like, yeah, he's a problem for real, for real.
Yeah.
Yeah, I see it.
Well, if it wasn't for Big Daddy Kane, we wouldn't have that energy. And I think as we celebrate 50 years of hip hop, we have to just, you know, make sure that we show love and support for artists like you, that you really kicked in the door. And even though you, you know, it didn't really feel good for you to go into MCA, that changed the game for a lot of rappers, that kind of money that rappers were able to make started to change because of that deal that you had. So it did get a little bit better, but also people believed in hip hop enough and started to pay you guys a little bit of your worth. I never think they've ever paid you all the worth of the money that you generate. But
that was a
moment. That contract was a moment.
Let me just say this real quick. See, with my deal, it was publicly known.
Yes.
But a lot of people don't know this, that, you know, I actually wasn't first. You know, Eric B and Rakim, they did $1 million deal. You know what I'm saying?
With MCA.
Yeah,
yeah,
with MCA.
That's right. That is correct.
You know, it just wasn't publicly known.
That's true.
You know, and Eric, you know, he was out there, you know, pushing the Rolls Royce back then.
Yeah.
You know, so, I mean, you know, much respect to Eric and Ra, because they had done that before me, actually.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
I didn't even know that, man. I had no idea.
Yeah,
I remember they was on MCA, though.
Yeah, that's, yeah, wow. Yeah. Nah, they, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I don't know if you know Eric, but he's a serious businessman.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, Eric B is a serious
businessman.
And a good dude, too.
Oh,
man.
Yeah. That's what, like, let me tell you what type of dude this is. Eric B is the type of dude where we'll be at my house on a Thursday night, sitting in the back room laughing and joking about some of the silliest stuff on the planet. Friday night, we'll be backstage at the concert, backstage, and he'll smooth walk past me like he don't even see me. Because he in his zone. You know? But yeah, he's a very smart, intelligent business mind. Yeah.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, let's give a round of applause to the legend Big Daddy Kane. And thank you for joining the Backstory Podcast.
Coming up on the next Backstory Podcast, actress, singer, Janelle Monáe.
You know, as much as, you know, you love your small town and where you grow up, I just had a dream of going to New York. And I got to give a shout out to my teachers who wrote my letters of recommendation. They really invested in me and helped me get to my performing arts school.
The Backstory Podcast with Colby Kolb is an Urban One Incorporated Reach Media Pod is Good production, hosted and executive produced by yours truly, Colby Kolb, edited by Donkus. Follow us on Twitter at BackstoryPCC, on Instagram, Get the Backstory. For sales and corporate partnerships, Josh Romani and Michelle Marino. Digital marketing, Walter Gaynor, J.R. Smith, and Tim Hall. Thanks again for listening to the Backstory Podcast.